And carry on is what we're going to have to do in the climate community, even though one of our heroes, Dave Roberts of grist.org, is unplugging for a year, and we are very pleased and honored to have him for a quick interview before he completely disappears. He unplugged officially a couple of days ago, so we really appreciate his being with us. We were supposed to have him last week, but I was on the road getting my daughter settled into NYU and couldn't quite do a live show. We brought you the best of Betsy. Hope you enjoyed that. But we have not only a live show, but a fabulous lineup for today. We'll be speaking to Dave in just a minute with D.R. Tucker joining in. In the second segment, we'll talk to someone who helped organize a protest yesterday against CNBC in New Jersey on their Englewood Cliffs headquarters, delivering a petition signed by some 45,000 people demanding that CNBC, which when they do cover climate, has mostly been mocking the crisis, that they not only provide more coverage, but get in touch with the facts and the science. So we'll hear all about that. And in our last segment, last but not least, we'll be speaking with a friend of mine, Osprey Oriole Lake, who is doing all kinds of important work in terms of organizing women around the globe on climate change. In fact, she's the founder and president of the Women's Earth and Climate Caucus and the co-director of the upcoming International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative, taking place in just a couple of weeks in New York. We'll find out all about that. Very happy to welcome to the show D.R. Tucker and Dave Roberts. Wow, surrounded by doctors here. Help me, help me. Hey, Dave.
Hey there, how's it going?
Good. How's it going for you? A couple of days, you're officially off-grid, and again, we really appreciate your being with us before you go under, as you will, and really we're moved by your essay about why you were leaving for a year and what you'd be doing. Getting fit, you said, getting your sanity back, getting the climate obsession exorcised somewhat, and your body and exorcise climate obsession, completely relate to that, and you called it the medium chill. Tell us all about what prompted this decision. I'm sure it wasn't one you or your family took lightly.
No, I've been thinking about it a good while. I've been at Grist writing about this stuff now for 10 years. And lately it had just started to seem to me, when I started it was 2003, 2004, and it was, you know, a very different political climate back then. It seemed frozen. It seemed like nothing could happen. It seemed like everybody was saying stupid things, and I would just come to work and fight all day, horrible things happening. And then, you know, there's this brief window where we all recall where it seemed like things might actually unfreeze and start moving a little bit and finally get serious about climate. And then it just kind of froze back up. And
you know what? Before you go on, that was the year that I decided to take a sabbatical. After Air America went off the air and my green show went into the faded to black, I said, I'm burnt out. I got to quit. And that was the year that everyone suddenly woke up to the green trend and the climate crisis, while I was nowhere to be found.
Your timing's off.
As always.
Yeah. So, you know, I just found myself feeling, you know, cranky all the time, cranky at my, you know, all the old enemies, cranky at my allies, cranky at everyone on Twitter, just feeling like I had said it all before, I'd heard it all before, I'd been through the same, you know, like I was on a treadmill just running in place. And, you know, so that was part of it. And part of it is just, you know, over time, the journalism world, the journalism gig, I think, has become much more immersive and full-time. And, you know, because of the speed of the news cycle now, you're never away, you're never off, you're never not working. And I had developed, you know, sort of bad habits, just being online all the time, being attached to a computer all the time. And, you know, I didn't really see how that was going to change anytime soon, so I felt like I needed to do, you know, something drastic and try some other things, and hopefully it will allow me to come back with a, you know, a different perspective.
How's it been so far?
Well, it's hard to, I mean, it's been Labor Day weekend, and I've just now gotten the kids to school for the first time today, so it's just been normally busy. This is like, honestly, this moment right now has been the first time where sort of everybody's gone, everybody else is at work, and I'm finally taking a breath and thinking, wow, what should I do? I can do anything.
Do an interview on climate change.
I can do nothing.
With the Green Front.
Yeah.
Well, we do appreciate it. And, you know, I say that with some envy, with some certainly a lot of respect, because it is hard to unplug. And yet I completely understand, and I know DR does as well, he's really attached to his computer. I mean, I wake up on the West Coast and my inbox is filled with, you probably are on the list too often, you know, pieces that D.R. Tucker picks up on the internet all about climate, and it sometimes feels, no, it often feels like it's just endless, and so much of it is reason to be cross, cranky, if you will. And, you know, you talk about the struggle back in 2004. I think you did an interview with me as the interactivist of the week when I was just starting my show EcoTalk on Air America. Well, here it is. Almost a decade later, and I'm on the internet. There is no dedicated green talk show on, you know, mainstream radio or television. In some ways, we haven't come that far in terms of, you know, media recognizing the gatekeepers, recognizing that this is the biggest story, that, you know, we have to begin somewhere by educating the public. You know, in a way, we still are facing that uphill struggle. I feel, you know, pushing the boulder up the mountain still.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with climate change, and this is true across domains, is just a time scale mismatch. You know, with the climate problem moves slowly, and big institutions like media and government and industry move really slowly. You know, it's like a gigantic ocean liner, and no matter how frantically you're turning the wheel, the thing just, you know, turns very, very slowly. So our kind of emotional lives are lived at this much faster pace than society changes or than the climate changes. And so it's easy for us to just feel like, you know, we're spinning our wheels and nothing's changing. I think it's part of the reason I'm taking a year off. I think part of the reason I want to step back and get some perspective is I think because we're so in it, because we're so immersed in it, I think we can miss the fact that there are big and very deep changes underway. They're just hard to see when you're in the middle of it and everything seems to be moving so slowly. So I think perhaps getting some perspective on that will help too, will help me see that it's not all been in vain, that there are things happening.
I know DR wants to jump in with a question, but I just have to say the only thing that's not happening slowly is actually climate change, you know, arriving.
Right.
Definitely. David, in one of your most recent pieces, you talked about the issue of communicating climate change on Twitter, and you mentioned, you know, you mentioned that was one of the things that you were doing heavily, and there was an interesting piece, I guess, in response from Jill Rome about, you know, communicating on Twitter, and I think your piece was a response to. What I wanted to get at, possibly as a pointer, is how do you deal with some of the, like, aggressive deniers on Twitter? I see you interacting with them, and I also see, you know, in a different vein, Jamel Bowie of the Daily Beast interacting with them. And, you know, my usual rule of thumb is just to block them, to basically, because they just remind me of cockroaches that you have to sort of, you know, remove as pests. But how do you deal with this level of sort of, you know, low IQ backwardness, basically?
Well, you know, I decided long ago that there was nothing to be gained by getting in these long back and forths with, you know, really committed ideological deniers. And it's, you know, it just becomes a matter of being able to tell who's who, you know, being able to tell who's committed and beyond reach and who is actually perhaps just kind of wandering into this, you know, carrying a few goofy notions but open to new thoughts or new ideas, new information. And that's the sort of radar, I think, that everybody needs to be able to develop on social media and online, is that ability to sort of tell when there's an opening, when there's possibility of real interaction, and when there isn't. And you know, when there isn't, when it's just sort of one of these really committed ideological right-wing guys who's just stomping around the internet trying to provoke people and troll people, those people I mostly just ignore. I never get involved with those people anymore, or I just sort of mock them. You know what I think? Because they're beyond information, they're beyond persuasion, and they're not really interested in any sort of exchange of information. It's purely theatrical, you know what I mean? They're coming at you to perform a bit of theater for other people watching. So I just treat it as theater. And theater is all about emotion, it's all about humor, it's all, you know, it's not about persuasion. So in that situation, I just mock them. It's much more, and it's liberating, honestly, not having to carry the burden of being the serious one who's got all the links to the PDFs and the right papers and everything. You know, sometimes that's just, it's a waste of your time and it's frustrating. But if you just approach it as kind of more of a theatrical play, I've found that's much more enjoyable for me. But again, you have to be able to tell when there's a possibility, because, you know, there are people I've been able to, you know, not change their minds, but at least have a sincere exchange of views, a sincere exchange of information with, who I never would have expected. So it's all about learning to tell the difference, I guess.
I know you're friends with Chris Hayes. What did you think of his recent documentary on climate change?
You know, I still haven't gotten to watch it. I was so busy. It came right during my last, you know, my last week online, and I was so busy trying to do 100 other things. I haven't gotten a chance to watch it yet.
But, well,
I have an immense amount of respect and affection for Chris. He's really, you know, he's sort of a model. He's intellectually absorbed this problem and decided, well, nobody else is covering it, so I have to do it. And it seems revolutionary and, you know, so unique, but when you think about it, it's obvious. It's what anyone with a platform like that ought to be doing. The question is, why are other hosts not doing what he's doing?
Exactly, and nowhere on the radio, because I've been trying to do that for 15 years. No exaggeration. It's just ridiculous how difficult it is. Although someone gave me some insight, actually Desi Doyen of the Green News Report. She said the problem is none of the mainstream outlets will consider doing anything that, you know, sounds like advocacy, and yet those of us who are, you know, on the Progressive Radio Network, and thank goodness we are, and there is that platform, but that's as far as we can get, are mostly talking to the choir, and therein lies the problem.
Well, I don't know. I tend to think, and I wrote a post about this once, I tend to think that so-called preaching to the choir is underrated. You know, the progressive choir is not where it needs to be on climate any more than sort of the general public is. And even those who sort of vaguely, you know, acknowledge it vaguely as a problem, something they ought to care about, very few have a very deep understanding or a very clear understanding of what it is, what needs to be done. So, and, you know, in politics, you need breadth, but you also need depth. You need a core of people who are deeply committed and active, and that's the choir. So, you know, firing up the choir, you know, you can look how it worked on the right. I mean, all the Tea Party is a choir, and the right has an entire network of media outlets devoted entirely to the choir, just to tending and feeding the choir and keeping them angry and keeping them activated. And it's incredibly, you know, it's not that large a number of people, but they're incredibly effective because they're loud and active, and you know, that's in their intense, and intensity is what wins in politics. So I think, you know, I certainly see the virtue of reaching kind of middle America and the disengaged, but I also think there's real virtue in reaching progressives and getting them, you know, educated and fired up about this.
First of all, David, if you know of any good copies lying around of Chris Hayes' show, send them around, because it appears that MSNBC has locked in a vault in 30 Rock or somewhere.
Oh, is it not online?
In fact, I did a piece for Brad Friedman's site about it a couple of days ago, pointing out that apparently MSNBC has absconded with all the footage, apparently due to a fear that they might, you know, irritate some of the advertisers. You know, those lovely shell ads, those shell ads might disappear if you see all the footage online. So that's why there's only about 4 minutes and 55 seconds of the video of the documentary online.
Funny.
But
I'm curious, did you guys hear anything about the ratings? Do we have any idea what the response was to the show?
I can't recall what the specific ratings of the show were. I know there was a recent story showing that Chris Hayes' show, the overall ratings for the show has gone up, but I can't recall the specific ratings for the broadcast. I certainly hope it did well, since that was apparently a one-time only broadcast.
Yeah,
but
I mean, I think it's we should acknowledge that this is, you know, it goes against a lot of advertiser interests, and
exactly,
you know, there's a lot of that going on. But I think we should also at the same time acknowledge that it is really, really genuinely difficult to present this problem in a way that is compelling on television. I mean, there's a reason that networks don't do more of it. I mean, I honestly think if climate change specials rocked the ratings, I don't think they would care what advertisers said. I think they would do whatever, you know, I think they'll chase ratings. I just don't think it's, you know, and I've talked with Chris about this before, it's just a really, really, really difficult problem for a lot of different reasons to make this the kind of thing that people want to hear about on the radio or watch on TV. And that's a problem I don't think anybody has really solved yet.
Well, that's the catch-22. Programmers, you know, assume that people aren't interested, and yet, again, this is the only experience I've had, but I did have it on Air America. We had 50,000 listeners a night, and the show was popular enough that they moved it from weekly to daily. So, you know, that was with zero marketing. So that was 6 years ago. So when people assume that's the case, I don't necessarily buy that, but I certainly understand the hurdles therein. And I wonder, Dave, what you think. How are Americans, adult Americans, because kids are going to get it by default, and there is some education, you know, going on in environmental studies programs, not just elementary school, but many colleges. How are adults supposed to learn not only the full extent of the problem? Like you said, progressives aren't very fully understanding, let alone those who are, you know, in the middle America range. How are we supposed to understand the full depth and scope of the problems, climate change being the great exacerbator of all of them, if we don't have anything between the scientific community and the public? Or, you know, there's GRIS, there's this show, but again, that's mostly talking to the already interested. You know, in President Obama's speech, he talked about, you know, talk to, you know, your fellow Americans about this issue. Well, it seems to me there should be, you know, some entity, some campaigns underway to really reach the American public in a way that depoliticizes this and really focuses on the practical part of it. And that, I don't really see it. Do you see that happening?
I don't see it happening, and part of it is that, you know, part of it is that it takes two to depoliticize. That's the problem. I mean, this is something I've been going back and forth with people about for 10 years now. You know, there's this yearning on the left, I think, to pull this problem out of the partisan scrum. You know, the clash of politics, the endless sort of quibbles and battles of left versus right. But you can't do that alone. You have to have partners on the right to do that. If the right wants to politicize it, you know, if the right says this is a left thing and we're against it, then it's politicized. The left cannot unilaterally sort of refuse to play in that game if the right chooses to do that. So, you know, so our choices are either find partners on the right who are willing to work with us to pull this out and make it nonpartisan, or, you know, I mean, the other way of looking at it is, and I've gone back and forth over time, the other way of looking at it is we're in the midst of a really vital and important clash of worldviews that's playing out in American politics, and climate is part of that clash. It really is, you know, it really is politicized in the sense that there are two very incommensurate worldviews battling it out. And so the way to make progress on climate is the same as the way to make progress on you know, social insurance or infrastructure investment or any of the other things that progressives want to do, which is win that, you know, clash of worldviews. It's gather power and use it and overcome the enemy. You know what I mean? As opposed to trying to sort of depoliticize and you know, for some reason the left just doesn't want to fight. It seems like we're so, you know, enamored of science and reason, we think we can all just sit down and work it out, That's just not how things work in the real world. You know, in the real world, it's a vicious fight, and it's about power. And sometimes I wish the left would just say, you know what, we're going to, by hook or crook, put together the power we need to make the things we want to happen. That's how the right thinks. They don't go stroking their chins, worrying how to depoliticize things. They think about how to win, and they've been fighting to win for decades now. So, you know, maybe we should just win it.
Couldn't agree more, Dave. In fact, that's why I asked DR to be my co-host, because, as you know, he's a former conservative Republican who changed his stripes after waking up to the climate crisis. Very compelling.
It is. It is. It doesn't take many, but they are fairly remarkable at maintaining discipline, at maintaining group unity.
We have to wrap up in just a minute, but DR, got to give you a chance to get your last question in for Dave.
Sure. Not so much a question, but an observation that what you say, what you just said, Dave, was validated or sort of reconfirmed by a remark that I, in an article in a Canadian newspaper that I sent to Betsy several hours ago, in which Marlo Lewis from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, that sort of Amazon front group, says specifically that the reason why Republicans should refuse to embrace a carbon tax is that the refusal to embrace such a tax and the refusal to accept climate science brands the Republican Party and gives the Republican Party political advantage as the anti-tax, pro-energy party. In other words, he's explicitly admitting that it's about nothing more than partisan political gain, not about any concern about policy,
sure.
Not about any concern about the common good. I mean, usually they're not that blatant in explaining what their motivation is to deny the science. But that remark from Mr. Lewis proves everything you just said, and in fact proves the point you made in one of your most recent pieces. And in fact, climate science cannot be made conservative friendly because it would require conservatives to concede too much of their perceived ideological or philosophical ground, and they will simply refuse to do that. They would rather literally drown than do something like that.
Well, right. And so, what do we do in response to that? We can either sort of clutch our pearls and break out the smelling salts and lament how gross and mean it is, which is what we've seen, which is what's been the majority response for decades now, this sort of tutting of the right and saying, you know, aren't you all ashamed? How, you know, but they aren't. They're not going to be. So, you know, the other response is just to give as good as you get, to punch back, to win. You know what I mean? I'd like to see more. I'd like to see. That's why I've been so heartened by the emergence of this climate movement that's really just about going in and punching. You know, they're about going in and trying to gain power, trying to make it politically painful to support this stuff. I mean, that's the real work. That's the real work is on the ground level, changing the balance of power.
Well, Dave, with that, we're going to have to bid you farewell. Good luck not working, and have a very cool medium chill. We'll miss you and your pieces a great deal, but we'll look forward to reconnecting in a year when, as you said, climate change will probably still be around.
Thanks so much. I'll see you in a year.
Grist taking a sabbatical, unplugging, but not before he spends a few minutes with us. Really appreciate that. We'll be back in just a minute. You're going to find out about a big protest, why CNBC was the target yesterday in New Jersey.